did read it, but to be honest, I read it such a long time ago, I don't remember it right now.
It's kind of like you have a corporatist society, but you know, you allow political dissent, but you make sure that they're suppressed, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but I don't think that there will be anything friendly about Trump. What there will be is an unfriendly reactionary movement, which may develop into fascism, but I don't think that's what is likely to happen, but it's going to be a reaction and democratic that essentially will try to deprive the American system of whatever democratic content it still has. And I say democratic content it still has because, in my view, I'm sure many people would agree with it, if you compare the United States with other capitalist democracies, you know, France, England, Germany, etc., this is the least democratic of the capitalist democracies. Look at the kind of election we have, where the Electoral College, you know, this is an archaic anti-democratic institution. The Senate is elected a completely undemocratic way for 6 years, and Wyoming, which is the state with the least population in the United States, has the same Senate power than California, which is absurd.
And then they didn't even used to elect the Senate directly. It used to be selected.
So as far as the Senate is concerned, Wyoming has two, and California has two. California has millions and millions of people. Wyoming, I think, barely has a million people, or something like that. Maybe not even that.
Of course, you could say the same thing about Vermont, which is where Bernie Sanders got elected.
You're absolutely right. I mean, Bernie Sanders became a very popular guy in this country, but not because of the number of Vermonters who support him. He became a popular figure in spite of that, not because of that.
That was retired Brooklyn College professor Samuel Farber speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg about his article for Jacobin called Donald Trump, Lumpin' Capitalist. This has been KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland.
New year, new KABU. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported KABU during our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign. With help from our community, we were able to reach our $75,000 goal and will be able to continue bringing you grassroots, independent community radio. If you didn't get a chance to contribute during our year-end campaign, you can still support KABU by becoming a member today. Go to kabu.fm/give and join the team.
Do you like discovering new music and reconnecting with some older but perhaps forgotten favorites? Then look no further. Tune into The Listening Room with host Timothy P. every other Thursday at 3 in the morning for a genre-bending 2.5-hour show where you never know what you might hear next, but you will be sure to be engaged and entertained.
Description starts with be fabulous all the time.
The mayor calls me on my cell phone and cares what I think.
We can change the world by being more fabulous, and you have that power every single day.
Billionaires in space. These guys will do anything to look down on us.
Under 18 kids can buy a gun, but they can't watch a drag queen tell a story. I thought we had moved past it, and now I'm realizing that this is sort of the life that I'm going to have the rest of my life, is dealing with this, because this isn't going to go away overnight.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. We'll get back to reporting queer news from around the world when our news wrap crew returns from their holiday break next week. This week, we're kicking off 2025 with an interview we first aired last July from the Mecca of genuine fabulousness.
Freedom, 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 freedom.
ricocheting through San Francisco's Golden Gates comes Darcy Drolinger, crowned by the city as the world's first drag laureate. Once upon a time, such a title might have been all in fun, but in these days of drag panic and performance bans, the job has more political significance. Out in the Bay's Eric Jansen chats with Drolinger and reveals his own secret passion.
How did drag come to you, or you to it? I mean, at what age did you first do drag?
Well, I think I was doing drag since I was about 3 years old. I was obsessed with Mary Poppins and wanted very much to dress up like Mary Poppins. And my mother took me to a thrift store and we got a dress and some high heels and an umbrella. And I ran around the house. And
that's so intense. They were supportive.
My parents are incredibly supportive. They're both professors and they're both artists and they're both very great intellectual minds and they just very open minds and open hearts. And so it's, you know, they've always marched the beat of their own drum, which at times in my life, I was a little kid, was a little embarrassing having such sort of quiet but eccentric parents. And I look back on it now and I realize how lucky I was. And so, you know, it was something there in my life that, you know, it wasn't something I did all the time necessarily, but something that I felt like I immediately knew I was good at, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and you could have fun with it.
And, you know, it was something that I did sort of for fun. And I started, you know, I've written many plays and musicals, and I would start writing myself characters from time to time. A lot of times I wouldn't be in my shows, but if I was, I'd write myself a character that could at least partially be in drag. But it wasn't until opening Oasis where I really had to make that decision to be like, this is going to be my full-time job. That's the moment where I've really come to terms with not having a drag name, for example, and what that meant walking through the world using the same name in and out of drag.
I'll just let listeners know that I know Darcy primarily because I take his class Sexitude and he's always in boy clothes. So I'm used to calling Darcy he. But all the media coverage I've seen, it's always she. So I may slip from time to time, and Darcy is not in drag at the moment, I will just say. So, we've heard of poet laureates, whose job is to elevate the status and appreciation of poetry. So, what does a drag laureate do?
You can use the exact same terminology, just throw in drag instead of poetry.
You were appointed in mid-May 2023. So, briefly, how has this first year been for you?
I mean, it's a very daunting task to take something on for the very first time, but also very exciting. You get to sort of carve it out and create the role. So it has been everything I thought it was going to be and much, much more. I was not expecting how much national and international press was going to come my way due to the states around the country working hard to ban drag and take away queer and trans rights. So it was, I was thrust in the spotlight a little harder than I expected.
I do remember you saying at the time that you found it fantastic and a little terrifying.
Yes. I mean, I think that it's something that we're finding out what a drag laureate does. Because drag has become so politicized so suddenly in a lot of ways. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, drag has always been political. Back from Compton cafeteria riots and Stonewall to just the bravery of doing something that, you know, those times was illegal, right? You go to jail.
Right.
If you're wearing
right.
over five pieces of the opposite sex clothing, which is so crazy to me because it wasn't.
Oh, they had a number. They actually had a number of five pieces.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the things I was thinking about when I was preparing for this interview, this conversation, is that on some level, it's one thing to just dress the way you feel like dressing. And it's another thing, it almost feels like if you dress against the norm to some extent, on some basic core level, it's a bit rebellious.
It is. And I mean, and you feel it when you walk down the street, you know. And it's also one of those things, you feel it at first, and the more you do it, the less you feel it, right?
Right.
And it becomes not so hard to do once you're more sort of comfortable walking in the world like that. I mean, I'll say San Francisco is pretty fabulous in the way that, you know, I can go out and drag, at least in the places that I go, and light up the room and light up the street, and people want to like say hi to me and take my picture and really do appreciate it in a way that I know that's not going to be how it is around the country. And it's one of the things I love about San Francisco, right? But I think that because the Drag Laureate thing sprung up at the same time that everything else was happening, that, you know, my talking points were a lot more about politics versus, you know, sparkle. It's very important. I talk about this in dance class.
You sit in this room and there's so much joy right now with all of us, and we're applauding each other, and we don't even all know each other's names, and we are still celebrating not just when we get it perfectly, but when we are just expressing ourselves and moving through the world. And the more that we can feel free to live in this space, to live in this energy, we are walking through the world really our truly authentic self, because each and every one of us is just a little different, right? And we all have that. Everyone who is alive wants to feel this joyous and this free. And it is contagious. And if we inspire other people, I say it all the time, but there's that much less room in their hearts and their minds for anger, hostility, prejudice. We can change the world by being more fabulous. And you have that power every single day. So go out and change the f-ing world.
For me, being the Drag Laureate was just elevating what I was already doing. I was already, you know, creating space for the community to perform. I was already working, with a number of different organizations to make things happen in the city. I was already sort of really embodying this idea of, if everyone is a little more authentic and more fabulous, they're busy doing that and they have less time in their hearts and their heads and for anger and hostility and prejudice. And it is amazing, the idea that we can live a more fabulous life at the exact same time we're transforming the world into a better place. And if nothing else, being able to just express that sentiment, that one sentiment, on a much bigger level, I think to me is made everything worth it, being the Drag Laureate. And there's all these other things that look good on paper, but really that ideology and embodying that in my life and as the Drag Laureate has been, you know, the most rewarding thing for me.
When you mentioned the class you teach a minute ago, you were talking about sex too.
I just
want to be sure I know. So here's San Francisco Mayor London Breed, who gave us a hint of why a Drag Laureate was important for the city, for the country, and the world when she announced your appointment.
The job description starts with "be fabulous all the time." It also is an important part of representing San Francisco. Representing San Francisco and our values for inclusion. Making sure that people know that no matter who you are or where you come from or who you love, you have someone who has a voice that will always represent you and speak on your behalf.
Did the city give you a formal job description, or how much of it was your free reign to create with this blank canvas?
It was a lot of that, and I think they gave me more free reign because I was so involved already in so many things. You know, there have been discussions along the way and ideas of things we want to work on together, me and with the city. I think that, you know, they're in the process of defining what it is as well, and looking at what I'm doing and what I've done when it's over will be, you know, part of understanding more of what they're going to want. I think that, you know, like Mayor Breed said, it really does show how important San Francisco is in terms of really letting the communities and the queer community have a voice in city politics and elevating us and seeing us. It's like we look from Jose Seria, from the court system that was created back in the day when when the community really needed to take care of each other because people weren't taking care of each other.
We're talking about the 1950s,
yeah,
so, right?
Yeah, yeah. Into now with like the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, which are really like, they are drag nuns and they are doing what nuns do. They are raising money. They are taking care of people. I mean, that all exists still here. The court system, we have two court systems here. We've got the Drag Laureate. We've got the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. Then we have other people like, you know, Juanita Moore and other drag personas that are doing so much community work. San Francisco is a very unique place that way. And I know that, you know, we can complain about all the stuff that isn't going right. But when I sit here right now and talk about all of this, it feels rather utopic, right? Is that the right word? It's like there is a drag utopia here where the drag community gets a place at the table.
Yeah.
Like a real place. serious place at the table. And, you know, I mean, the mayor calls me on my cell phone. That's pretty fabulous, you know, and cares what I think, uh-huh. you know?
Yeah.
And so I don't know that we'll have figured out everything for the Drag Laureate when I'm done, but I do hope that I can at least create some things that could be replicated each year. Like we did the SF is a Drag, where we had 2 days of drag performances on 60 street corners, which was a very complicated thing to put together. But it came off fabulously, and like that's something that I could see happening and being something that the Drag Laureate does and participates with. Like I have my own nonprofit that this could go through, but maybe the Drag Laureate picks a nonprofit that they work together to, you know, sort of sponsor and co-create the SF as a Drag. And maybe someday that would turn into like the Day of Music in Paris, where everyone goes to the streets and plays music mm-hmm. all over the city, and they vie for the best corners. And what if every drag queen on the same day every year just came to the streets and just filled the streets?
And other people just got into it, just
yeah,
the general public.
Exactly. I mean, that would be my fantasy, as if it became such a thing and people would come to San Francisco to come for the Day of Drag, where drag took over everywhere. And everyone, you know, at the coffee shops, the baristas were in drag. Everyone's in drag. Like a Day of Drag would be incredible. I see your true colors shining through. I see your true
colors. That's why I love you. More with San Francisco Drag Laureate Darcy Drollinger after this brief and important message.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
San Francisco's Drag Laureate streams live from his drag and trance haven night spot, Oasis.
Hi, I'm Darcy Drollinger, and you're watching Hot Trash Live. Our top trash, billionaires in space. First up, Richard Branson, you know, the Virgin guy. Well, Virgin guy popped his space cherry last week in a rocket that he fully funded with his bags of money. Good for you, Virgin guy. Jeff Bezos, the Amazon guy, announced he's also going to space and posted a suspiciously sincere good luck message along with a picture of Virgin guy. And Elon Musk, the Tesla guy, actually bought a ticket on the next Virgin Galactic rocket, even though he already owns SpaceX. I mean, the new must-have billionaire accessory isn't a wife half your age and a dragon's horn of stolen wealth. It's a fully functioning space plane in your own private hangar. Remember when entire countries used to do this and NASA was like a fully funded government agency at the cutting edge of interstellar technology? Well, who needs those losers? These guys took all the money they should have been paying in taxes and dumped it into their personal planetary pet projects. But I'm sure spaceflight will trickle down in a few hundred years or so, right? Like, seriously, these guys will do anything to look down on us. They really put the ass in astronaut. What? Look, I'm just saying, they're really out to launch. No. Okay, I'll stop. You guys, you just don't understand the gravity of these puns. Look, I'm gonna hit you with so many puns, you'll be seeing stars. God, it's like performing into a black hole. All right, fine, I'm leaving. I need some space. All right, I gotta go. I'll galaxy you later.
I just wanna stay for a minute. You're all so sexy and so fabulous. But we're living in some crazy, crazy times, right? Where they are creating bans on drag around this country, right? And I look at this crowd and what's happening on stage, and there's so much joy in this room. There's so much love in this room. And there's so much artistry in this room. So this is the time where we gotta sparkle harder. We gotta sparkle brighter. And you know, we live stream this tonight, right? So to all our families, brothers and sisters, and everyone in between watching this, that are over there, let those cameras, let's give them some love. We love you!
From his live stream show at Oasis, San Francisco drag laureate Darcy Drollinger rejoins correspondent Eric Jansen in studio to talk more about the onslaught of drag persecution in the U.S. culture wars.
So, when, how, and why did drag become politicized? Especially recently, it seems to have become such a flashpoint in our country's culture wars.
Yes, it is. It has sort of been a shock, I think, to the whole community, because the feeling was that we were moving so far past this, and now we're moving backwards in such a you know, a harsh way. I mean, it's not just drag performers and trans people, and, you know, trans people are just more visible now. The same prejudice has been there. I feel like suddenly it's emboldened because of the politics we're in. I mean, I'd say the same thing for women's reproductive rights. I never thought we would be going backwards, and now they're trying to put a major federal ban, you know. It is insane to me. So I do feel like, you know, in some ways these people just could never speak about it. It wasn't acceptable to be that level of prejudice or that level of misogynist anymore, and things have changed, and somehow they feel like they can be. And I can't believe that we're even having to have these conversations. I thought, like, really, I thought we had moved past it. And now I'm realizing that this is sort of the life that I'm going to have the rest of my life, is dealing with this, because this isn't going to go away overnight.
Right.
And it makes you realize how important our freedoms are, mm-hmm. and how we have to be pretty vigilant all the time to keep our freedoms that we take for granted. And, like, you know, I'm in a bubble inside a bubble inside a bubble, right? You know, I'm in the United States, I'm in California, I'm in San Francisco, I'm in the queer community in San Francisco. And it doesn't get any more sort of free as that, but it also doesn't get any more insular than that, right? Where, you know, I can't travel around the country or the world and have these kinds of freedoms. You know, I did an interview with the BBC Global, you know, early on in the Drag Laureate time, and the amount of comments that were like hate comments, like serious hate comments, because people in other cultures that are where it's very acceptable to kill gay people, right. Let alone drag queens
and trans people.
Trans people, and so you don't realize how much sort of hate there is in the world around just you existing.
Yeah.
Is. And so it's a big bummer, but it's also, I have the freedom to like kiss whoever I want to in broad daylight on the street. I have the freedom to dress in drag and walk down the street. I have the freedom to be so much exactly who I want to be. And so if I don't take that opportunity, like, it is really a shame, because for all the people that are never going to get this opportunity, and if I'm going to not take advantage of it, like, you are not walking through the world standing up for all those people that don't get the opportunity by ignoring that opportunity when it's right in front of you. And I think we don't celebrate it enough, and we don't take advantage of it enough, because we owe it to all those people that don't.
Okay. I just found this today and I was surprised, because I was checking on the status of anti-drag legislation across the United States. I knew that Tennessee was the big one that passed it last year, but also Montana and at least 15 other states have bills in progress to restrict drag performances, according to a report by the nonprofit World Population Review. Some of these laws are quite severe. Under Arizona's pending legislation, drag artists who perform in front of children under 15 years old would be subject to at least 10 years in prison and forced to register as sex offenders, says that report. But most of the states plan to appeal those rulings, so in those states, there may soon be no drag queen story hours for the kids in schools and public libraries like we have here in California, nor for anyone anywhere outside where minors might just happen to walk by.
But you can take them to a WWF wrestling match and watch people beat the hell out of each other.
And gun shows, I suppose.
Yes, sure. And I mean, you know, for these under 18 kids, they can buy a gun, but they can't watch a drag queen tell a story. And I also think things like that, that are, you know, they're really also coming after the parents. Right. And all of these red states want less government and more personal freedom, but they only want their own personal freedom. They don't want personal freedom that they don't approve of, because really these kids aren't like running away from home to get to the library for the drag story hour. Right. They're being taken there by their parents who want them to have that experience. I mean, drag story hour is created by Michelle T. because she wanted something special for her children, and she just did it for her kids, and it just started growing and growing and growing, and because people wanted it.
Is there anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't touched on yet?
You know, I think that it's been a really profound, you know, time with the Drag Laureate role, in sort of in conjunction with coming out of the pandemic with the nightclub and really finding a bigger, stronger voice for Oasis in terms of its place in the world, not just in San Francisco, but as a place for other performers, other kings and queens and trans performers to have a home. Drag has been something that's plopped in a bar somewhere, and you got to like turn some milk crates into a stage or dance on the pool table and change in the electrical closet or the public bathrooms. But to be able to have a space that has been created for you and your needs as a performer, with good dressing rooms and a bathroom and a closet and electricity back there and staff that, like, you know, welcomes you, that you aren't, you know, just another stranger coming into a club, but you are coming home. And I think the more that we can create those environments for performers, it affects the performers and it also affects the audiences. And I think that is a way that we can elevate what drag is. And I also think, you know, drag is this fluid art form that is more like a lens that you can put over any other art form. And it's like when you look at something and you're used to seeing it one way, but then you look at it under a microscope or a magnifying glass, it suddenly blows it up and it looks like something completely different. And you can see parts of it that you could never see before. And I think that drag does that, where it blows up. It's larger than life. It blows up the masculine identity. It blows up the feminine identity. And you start to be able to see things in a different perspective. I think that drag has a lot to offer if people could take it more seriously.
My guest was San Francisco Drag Laureate Darcy Drollinger. Thanks so much, Darcy, for spending so much time with us here. Learn more at darcydrollinger.com or sfoasis.com.
So don't be afraid to let them show your true colors. True colors are beautiful like a rainbow.
This interview with San Francisco Drag Laureate Darcy Drollinger was co-produced by Eric Jansen and Porfirio Rangel for Out in the Bay. David Kwan did the sound design and audio editing for the original full-length interview, which you can hear online at outinthebay.org. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. Thanks to Out in the Bay's Eric Jansen for sharing his conversation with San Francisco Drag Laureate Darcy Drollinger. The Village People, Cindy Lauper, Paul Simon, and Chase performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Jim Kennedy of Dayton, Ohio, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors to the nonprofit Overnight Productions, Inc. make this program possible. Ask us how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on KHEN, Salida, Colorado, KPFT, Galveston, Houston, Huntsville, Texas, CFRC, Kingston, Ontario, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and have a very queer new year, y'all.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Goodbye.
In brief, Turing invented the digital computer, if anybody did. He played a major role in preventing a German invasion of Britain. And he was persecuted, arguably to death, for being gay.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. Liechtenstein toasts the new year with marriage equality. China cracks down on gay erotic fiction online, and computing, the enigma of Alan Turing. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Ava Davis.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the 3 weeks ending January 11th, 2025. Liechtenstein rang in 2025 with its first legal gay and lesbian marriages. Parliament voted nearly unanimously to open civil marriage to same-gender couples last May, and the measure took effect on January 1st. Liechtenstein is home to about 40,000 people. It's bound to become a new wedding and honeymoon destination for lesbian and gay couples drawn to its picturesque alpine location between Austria and Switzerland. Queer couples can already marry in those countries and in Germany. Liechtenstein is the last German-speaking country to enact marriage equality. The fourth smallest European country is the 22nd on the continent to do so. Civil unions that do not confer the same rights as marriage have been available to same-gender couples since 2011. If a couple so desires, those unions can be converted to full marriage. Liechtenstein is a socially conservative country and only hosted its first LGBTQ Pride celebration in 2022.
Lithuania's version of a no-promo-homo law was struck down by the Constitutional Court in late December. It was called the Law on the Protection of Minors Against the Detrimental Effect of Public Information, and it was enacted in 2009. Like its forebears, it banned what it called the promotion of same-gender relationships to minors. It included a ban on any positive depiction of LGBTQ people in children's books and restricted the representation of LGBTQ people on public television. The small Eastern European nation's top court declared the measure unconstitutional on several grounds. The justices decided that exposing minors to information about diverse families is not automatically inappropriate. In fact, they found that the law hinders minors' development into mature, well-rounded individuals. The court said that the state has a constitutional duty to ensure harmonious and comprehensive child development, and that the restrictions are incompatible with that goal. The No Promo Homo law had also been found to be incompatible with the European Convention on Human Rights. Activists had mounted challenges against it at the European Court of Human Rights. Still, the Lithuanian Gay League says that the law created a significant chilling effect, leading to self-censorship among LGBTIQ+ individuals, organizations, and media outlets. LGL's victory statement declares, "The decision upholds the constitutional understanding that family, as a protected institution, can be formed on bases other than marriage, and emphasizes the importance of providing youth with information that reflects real social relationships and promotes respect for human rights and dignity." Same-gender sex has been legal in Lithuania since 1993, and openly gay and lesbian people can serve in the military. However, marriage equality is banned, and same-gender couples have no legal rights. A 2023 poll by the global think tank Globsec ranked Lithuania last in support for marriage equality among European Union nations.
Online gay erotic fiction is being targeted by the government of China, labeling such material as social evil. More than 50 people have been arrested since June of 2024, according to local news outlets and social media posts. Haitang Literature is a popular Taiwan-based website for adult fiction that allows writers to earn money from tips and subscriptions. One top writer on the site with the pen name Huan Shang Bian Xian was sentenced to 4.5 years in prison, according to Radio Free Asia. Writer Se Shi is serving 5.5 years behind bars, and Yi Xia was sentenced to 1 year and 5 months in prison. Details about the prosecutions of other detained writers have not yet been made public. So-called obscene material has been against the law in China since 1997. The law bans disseminating obscene electronic messages in publications, films, video and audio recordings, and images containing depictions of sexual acts. Despite these restrictions, the Danmei genre of gay male romance and sex stories has been gaining in popularity. Those clicks are significant, since 50,000 views or a profit of 50,000 yuan can mean 10 years in jail. Writers whose work earns more than 250,000 yuan can go to prison for life if they fail to pay back what amounts to about $34,000. Operators of pornographic websites can be jailed for up to 12 years. Some reports claim that individuals enjoying pornography in their own homes have also been prosecuted.
One of the men caught up in recent raids on Moscow gay night spots has died in police custody. Authorities are calling Andrei Kotov's December 29th death a suicide, noting that he was discovered covered in blood and that cuts were found on his body. In reports of the raids, Kotov was singled out as the person behind Men Travel. Kotov had testified in court that he had been beaten and tortured with electric shocks to force a confession. Vladimir Putin's legislative and judicial sycophants have been prosecuting alleged proponents of their imagined international LGBT movement as extremists. The 48-year-old travel agent was charged with creating an extremist community in which propaganda of the ideology of an association recognized as an extremist organization and banned by the court in the territory of the Russian Federation was carried out. The charges against Kotov went on to say, the defendant and active participants who supported the views and activities of the extremist through trips, public events, and the publication of images on the internet formed a false impression among citizens about the institution of marriage enshrined in the Constitution of the Russian Federation and carried out actions aimed at undermining traditional family values. It is not unusual for those considered subversive to be found dead, supposedly by suicide, in Russian prisons. Putin's crackdown on all things queer in recent years has also included bans on gender-affirming healthcare, marriage equality, and adoption.
Finally, veterans booted from the U.S. military under anti-queer policies have won a class action lawsuit against the Defense Department. More than 35,000 former service members will get to update their discharges, removing references to their sexual orientation. Those with dishonorable discharges will be able to apply for an immediate review. Approval by a federal judge is pending. The lawsuit was originally filed by a group of LGBTQ veterans in 2023. It dramatically improves efforts by the Biden administration to streamline the process for unfairly discharged queer service members seeking redress, especially those booted under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The onus will now be on the Pentagon to initiate the upgrades. Biden issued pardons to thousands of service members convicted under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. What was once Article 125 of the code criminalized consensual sodomy. It was updated in 2013 to punish only forcible acts. Monetary damages were not sought. The settlement asks the court to approve a $350,000 payment by the Pentagon to cover the plaintiff's legal costs. Elizabeth Kristen is a senior staff attorney with Legal Aid at Work, a group that helped file the suit. She called the settlement long overdue justice to LGBTQ plus veterans who served our country with honor but were stripped of the dignity and recognition they rightfully earned due to discriminatory discharge policies. In her words, it marks a crucial step in addressing this deep-seated injustice and ensuring these veterans receive the acknowledgement and respect they have long been denied.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the 3 weeks ending January 11th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Ava Davis. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay safe.
You see, it's all clear. You are meant to be here.
I'm Stephen Fry. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "The only sin is stupidity." That is why it is imperative that we stay as informed as possible. An excellent way to do this is to listen to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter,
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
British mathematician Alan Turing was still somewhat of an enigma in the early days of This Way Out. The 1983 best-selling biography had not yet made his tragic story legendary. A highly acclaimed play starring Derek Jacobi closed on Broadway just a week after This Way Out's 1988 debut, but the name Turing was still not a household word. Before the dawn of the computer age that brought Alan Turing's work its rightful recognition, before the honors that were to come on our November 23, 1988 program, it made perfect sense to lead into this program produced by Hugh Young and presented by Barry Epson with the question, Alan who?
Well, you might ask. And the probability that you don't know is an important part of his story. In brief, Turing invented the digital computer, if anybody did. He played a major role in preventing a German invasion of Britain. And he was persecuted, arguably to death, for being gay. Alan Turing's father, Julius, was in the Indian Civil Service, administering most of South India. But in 1907, he was on the way home on leave when he met Ethel Stoney. She had attended Cheltenham Ladies' College, whose principals, Miss Buss and Miss Beale, are still remembered in the rhyme.
Miss Buss and Miss Beale, Cupid's darts do not feel. Oh, how different from us are Miss Beale and Miss Buss.
Ethel did feel Cupid's dart, and she married Julius and returned to India with him the following year. They were on leave again when Alan was born, in Paddington. They returned to India again, and Alan was virtually brought up by other old India hands, rather stiffly and unimaginatively. In 1926, he began secondary schooling at Sherborne. Alec Waugh wrote the classic gay novel The Loom of Youth about Sherborne. His first and almost his only love affair was there, with Christopher Morcombe, who was 1 year older. The relationship was probably never consummated. They shared an interest in mathematics, and Christopher gained a scholarship to Trinity College, Cambridge, while Alan failed. But in early 1930, Christopher died of tuberculosis. Alan was heartbroken. A second attempt at Trinity also failed, but he gained a scholarship to King's instead.
The sun on the meadow is summery one. The stag in the forest runs free.
In 1934, he visited Germany. He was in Hanover on June the 30th, the night of the Long Knives, when the SA was overthrown and its head, Ernst Röhm, was dragged from his lover's bed and shot as a filthy pervert. Hitler gained supreme power, and it was the end of the decadent Germany that Christopher Isherwood had celebrated. Many people around the world, not yet aware of the extent of Hitler's evil, rejoiced. That year, aged only 22, Turing was made a Fellow of King's. He worked on the question, what is the most general type of cipher or code possible? And closely related, the most general kind of machine to deal with symbols. Starting from a typewriter, he developed the idea of what is now called a Turing machine, a machine that could read and write marks on an endless paper tape, and given the proper programming, carry out any operation on symbols. In 1937, he completed his major work, Computable Numbers, which laid the basis for computers as we know them. He also concerned himself with the practicalities, experimenting with gear wheels and electrical relays, getting his hands dirty in a way not customary to Cambridge dons.
I hope
it became clear to the world that war was inevitable. But in October 1938, he and a friend found some escape in the new Disney film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Alan was very taken with the scene in which the Wicked Witch dangled an apple on a string into a boiling brew of poison, muttering,
"Dip the apple in the brew, let the sleeping death seep through."
He liked to chant the couplet over and over. September 1939. And he reported the day after war was declared to the GC and CS, the Government Code and Cipher School at Bletchley Park in Buckinghamshire. Now Turing's speculations on ciphers came into their own. The German Navy and Air Force used a code known as Enigma. Unlike other codes of the day, Enigma was easy to use. Sender and receiver had identical, fairly simple machines with keyboards. They systematically changed one letter of the alphabet for another, like the simple codes we played with as children. But the Enigma machines changed the code after every letter. Obviously, if your enemy also has a machine, they can read your messages. That is, if they start at the same position. To increase the number of possible starting positions, the Germans added various refinements, but they changed their starting position only once a day. The code was solved by finding a pattern in the traffic of each day that betrayed that day's starting position. This was done mechanically, at first using punched cards carrying all possible patterns, later using a large number of machines that stepped through all possible positions in a short time. In February 1941, a German trawler was captured off Norway and the commanding officer killed before he could destroy a set of Enigma instructions. This enabled the GC and CS to read all naval traffic for that month, and by May, they were deciphering messages within a day. By June, the same day. So, Turing's work proved vital in the war in the Atlantic. In the spring of 1941, Alan proposed to another cryptanalyst, Joan Clark. He warned her he had homosexual tendencies, which was less than the truth. Eventually, he decided that it couldn't work and broke it off. He was known around the park as the Prof, even though they were all academics there. Among his eccentricities, he was unconcerned with his appearance, held his pants up with whatever came to hand, shaved with an early electric razor, leaving a 5 o'clock shadow. In the hay fever season, he wore a handkerchief over his nose. He could be abrupt, not suffering fools gladly. Turing's work on Enigma ended with a whimper rather than a bang, and he went to America to liaise with their cryptanalysts. His security rating was the highest. In America, he worked on speech encoding. The method he used is now commonplace, digital sampling, like the code on compact discs, only with mathematical operations on the digits to disguise them. The day the war ended, a friend said, "Now you can tell us everything." Turing said, "Don't be silly." And he never did. But his work on codes proved valuable at the National Physical Laboratory at Teddington when he worked on the automatic computing engine, or universal machine, what was known then as the electronic brain, and what we would call a computer. He showed that with a large, fast memory, the hardware could be very simple. There didn't need to be a special part of the computer to add or multiply, just a set of instructions in the program to use more basic instructions as often and as necessary for addition or multiplication to occur. In fact, a computer just needed to imitate adding or multiplying. If the symbols 1 plus 1 times 2 times 3 were always decoded as 12, that was enough. In the same way, the computer was imitating human thinking, and the Turing test is still used today in considering the unsolved question, can a machine think? Can a machine fool a human into thinking he or she is communicating with another human? However, because of his personality, he found it hard to communicate what was so clear to him to engineers, or even lesser mathematicians, and the bureaucracy got in the way. One of Turing's superiors cheerfully stripped the logic functions from the proposed computer, turning it into a giant calculator. The outcome is history. the early development of computers fell to the Americans, and by 1950, Turing was being written out of the history of the computer. Turing machine is sometimes written with an umlaut, as if it were German. Turing. Turing went on with his own ideas, which he called abbreviated code instructions, and we would call high-level languages. He saw, as few people did then, that a computer was not confined to numbers. One of his recreations was programming a computer to imitate that uniquely mathematical and uniquely English art form, change ringing. He wrote short stories, thinly disguised autobiography. One mentions picking up another gay man. In using that word, as in so much else, he was years ahead of his time. Late in 1951, Alan picked up Arnold Murray, 19, working class, but not rough trade exactly, vivacious and with a sense of humor. On their second meeting, Alan took him home and they spent the night together, and two more nights together. Arnold was poor, but he wouldn't accept money directly. On the 23rd of January 1952, Alan's house was burgled. Arnold said a friend, Harry, had done it. Alan, with typical innocence, went to the police and described Harry to them. And when they questioned him further about how he knew, he blurted out just about everything. Alan Matheson Turing, being a male, and Arnold Murray, being a male, were convicted of 1. Committing an act of gross indecency, plus 1. Being a party to the commission of an act of gross indecency, times 2 men, times 3 nights, a total of 12 sexual crimes, and that was enough. Turing wouldn't parade his war record, considering it irrelevant. If anything, his class counted against him. Arnold was conditionally discharged. Turing was bound over not to repeat his crime, and offered the choice of prison or organotherapic treatment, as the local paper put it. Turing didn't want to stop work and accepted the treatment. Female hormones. They made his breasts grow and made him impotent, although not desire-free. He interpreted the instruction not to repeat his crime literally and went overseas, to Norway and Greece, for sexual contact. After a year, Alan had a doctor remove the hormone implant from his thigh. One of its effects, at least in rats, is as a cerebral depressant. The experiment wasn't repeated on many humans, so whether it produces depression in the ordinary sense is unclear. 10 months later, with no warning whatever, on June the 7th, 1954, Alan Turing dipped an apple in a brew, let the sleeping death seep through, and bit the apple. His mother refused to believe it was suicide. He had often used potassium cyanide in his experiments. One was still brewing in another room. Perhaps he arranged it this way to spare her feelings. There's no memorial, unless you count every computer in the world. One enigma remains. What would computers be like today if Alan Turing hadn't killed himself? Well, as another gay Cambridge mathematician, Ludwig Wittgenstein, said, "Wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen." Of what we cannot speak, thereof must we be silent.
There are plenty of memorials to Alan Turing now. There's a statue of Turing sitting on a park bench holding an apple in Manchester, England's gay village of Sackville Gardens. It was financed in 2001 by gay actor Derek Jacobi, who played the ill-fated genius on stage and television in Breaking the Code. Prime Minister Gordon Brown publicly apologized in 2009 for the unfair treatment Turing received. The British Postal Service issued a stamp honoring Turing in 2012, and Queen Elizabeth II granted him a royal pardon in 2013. The biopic, The Imitation Game, cast Benedict Cumberbatch as the persecuted gay icon and won Graham Moore the 2015 Oscar for the Best Screenplay Adaptation. In 2021, a Bank of England 50-pound note featuring Turing went into circulation, and today the criterion known as the Turing test is central to the conversation about artificial intelligence. Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. The Enigmatic Life of Alan Turing was presented by Barry Epson and written and produced by Hugh Young. Cat Stevens, the Pet Shop Boys, and Electric Light Orchestra performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks David Hunt of Raleigh, North Carolina, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media. Email us at info@thiswayout.org or write us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on 2XX Canberra, Australian Capital Territory, KGAY, Thousand Palms, Coachella Valley, California, WGGT, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and a wide array of community, terrestrial, and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
You are tuned to KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.